Jones. Good afternoon, friends, and thanks for tuning in to Animal Voices. With me today are Carl Loskin and Marge Adams. I'm John Pranger, and you certainly are in for a treat because Connie Vogel, leader of the Canadian Action Party, is sitting in the studio with us today to discuss her political party's platform and the issues that aren't being talked about in the media or the debates. And she's known to many people as a lawyer, former teacher, and widow of famed City Councilor Harry Rankin. Also in the studio today is Andrew Scott, who lectures for the Stanley Park Ecological Society, and their website is stanleyparkecology.ca. He's going to give us a look into the marvelous world of insects and the vital role they play in the ecology of the Earth. But first, a little glimpse into the brave new world of science and medicine, given to us courtesy of Philip Morris, the giant tobacco company that makes people ill and kills them with their infamous products. Philip Morris has announced its plans to build a 450,000 square foot research and development facility in Richmond, Virginia, that appears to include an expanded animal research center. According to undisclosed sources, the design plans for the facility contain rooms labeled Primate Room 1 and Primate Room 2. What makes this discovery even more dismaying is the fact that Philip Morris has been linked with Covance Laboratories, and you can go to their website, covancecruelty.com, which is put up by PETA. That's covancecruelty.com, where a recent PETA undercover investigator videotaped employees grossly abusing monkeys. Well, for decades, of course, tobacco companies such as Philip Morris have used animal experiments to mislead people into believing that smoking was safe, because animals don't get cancer when they are forced to smoke cigarettes. This is particularly misguided for this reason, because they don't develop these cancers in the same way that human beings do anyway. Now, Philip Morris plans to expand its research into further attempts to fool the public into believing that smoking its cigarettes can be less harmful. Dogs, rats, monkeys, and rabbits are hooked up to machines and forced to inhale cigarette smoke in vain attempts to prove that cigarettes are safe. Oftentimes, researchers use pregnant animals to determine how smoking affects newborns, despite the abundance of evidence proving that it causes harm. In a recent study, pregnant rhesus monkeys were hooked up to mechanized pumps and forced to ingest nicotine for more than 3 months. The monkeys' fetuses were then surgically removed before reaching full term and killed so that their lungs could be dissected and examined. Richmond Mayor Douglas Wilder, who signed the Virginia Indoor Clean Air Act while he was governor of Virginia, has revealed that the city gave Philip Morris several acres of city property assessed at $3.2 million, along with a 10-year abatement in property taxes for the facility. PETA wrote a letter to Mayor Wilder, and you can find that on their website, urging the mayor to withdraw the city's financial commitment to the project, unless Philip Morris provides assurances that no animal experimentation will take place at the facility. Until smoking really is history, Philip Morris will do anything it can to make sure that its bottom line is healthy, but it continues to do so at the expense of animals. There are numerous alternatives to animal research, including clinical trials and epidemiological studies using volunteers who smoke. If you want to contact the CEO and chair of Philip Morris USA, please go to the PETA website, which is PETA.org, P-E-T-A.org. We'll take a bit of a breather And then we'll be right back with Andrew Scott of the Stanley Park Ecology Society. This is Animal Voices, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, 102.7 FM.
Yes, this is Marge Adams, and I would like to introduce my guest today, whose name is Andrew Scott. Andrew is an artist who sculpts insects out of plastic and metal. He is also a nature interpreter and lecturer who conducts nature walks in Vancouver for the Stanley Park Ecology Society. We are really very excited about having Andrew on our show today. He is our very first guest able to talk with authority about bugs. Welcome to Animal Voices, Andrew.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Now, there are over a million species of insects, so this is a very vast topic that you're launching into. You have chosen, however, to focus primarily on ant supercolonies, but maybe we could start by having a brief overview of the world of insects.
Okay. When you say that there are a million species of insects on Earth, that's only how many species that we've actually cataloged. There's actually an estimated 4 million additional species that have not been put onto the books. So there's an incredible amount of information yet to be learned about insects and their roles on Earth and how they affect our ecology. But it's pretty safe to say that for the last 60 or so million years, insects have shaped all distribution of plant life, as well as handling of broken down organic matter and waste on the surface of the globe. And without them, our planet would be in incredibly rough shape very rapidly. All humans would starve without the pollination of our plants and grains and fruits and things like that. To put it into perspective, every kernel of corn has been personally visited by a bee. They have dropped a piece of pollen at the tip of the hair on the cob of corn. And when you pick up a cob of corn and some of the corn kernels haven't fully germinated, that's because they weren't visited by insects. So without their help, the crops that we take for granted would vanish within less than a year.
It's amazing. And we have such a negative view generally, don't we, of insects? We think of them so often as pests.
Yes, there's a really lucrative market out there for people attempting to control insects. One thing that I've learned through my research and just through talking to people is that the only way you can really control insects is by working with them and not against them. When you work against them, you tend to create temporary solutions that end up harming ecology and environments in the long run.
Yes, I'm sure we are doing that all the time, aren't we, with our bug sprays and just a whole lot of other things that we do to abolish the insects.
Yeah, and it's pretty much a mark of North American culture to treat insects with fear and reproach when really in other places in the world we see that their role is understood and they're looked after and respected a lot more.
Yeah, they do have, besides man, of course, they have a lot of other enemies, don't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they're, but, you know, generally they do pretty well without man's interference. And, you know, they fight among themselves, but generally they keep themselves in balance. And they've managed to do what they've done for a long time without our interference.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about birds and snakes, for example.
Oh, yes,
fish, but anteaters, they all control the insects in our minds, don't they?
They sort of do, but in a way, it's the insects that allow those creatures to thrive. So it can be looked at in reverse, that the insects control those creatures, because without them, those creatures would vanish as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned to me earlier about the insects shaping the evolution of life. Maybe you could expand on that for us.
Well, we look around our natural environment and we take a lot of things for granted that are relatively newcomers to our planet. When we look at flowering plants and trees, 65 million years ago, none of those things existed on Earth. There were no blades of grass. There was nothing that reproduced sexually and germinated seeds. That type of plant organism has evolved symbiotically with the pollinating insect species that also arrived on Earth 40 to 60 million years ago. So they've literally created the environment as we know it.
I see. Interesting. Now, I know that your favorite topic at the moment is ant super colonies, so I'm going to say to you, please tell us about them.
Okay, yeah. Ant super colonies are a fascinating development in insect evolution and in insect culture. It surprises me that more people aren't aware that these super colonies exist because they are quite staggering in proportion and they're showing up all around the world. The largest and most impressive ant supercolony currently exists on the northern shore of the Mediterranean in Europe. It's an organization of unrelated ants that functions as a massive colony, and it exists right along the waterfront, starting in Italy and continuing all the way through Portugal and back into Spain. It's a 6,000-kilometer biological organization, the largest biological organization ever to have existed on Earth. For some perspective, it dwarfs the Great Barrier Reef significantly, and scientists at the moment are at a loss for a genetic explanation for why this change in ant behavior has occurred. So the way ants have been understood traditionally by the world of science is they believe their behaviors are motivated by genetic programming. However, there really is no genetic explanation for why these ants have suddenly changed their behavior and started to cooperate and created these massive super colonies.
Are they above ground or are they hidden?
Well, they're not very noticeable. They are just very dense colonies. They're below the ground. They exist in urban environments, and they exist along the beachfront. And they're also turning up in places like Melbourne, Australia, where they actually exist exclusively within the city limits. And California as well is home to another colony, super colony of Argentine ants. And other species of ants as well have gone super colonial, the redwood ant in Hokkaido and the yellow crazy ant on Christmas Island are both ants that have gone super colonial, and in the case of Christmas Island, there have been some catastrophic environmental effects.
Well, I wonder, how come they're allowed to do that? I mean, isn't man in there trying to prevent it?
Generally. Man seems to be thwarting some of the super-colonial efforts of the ants in Hokkaido. They're near the city of Sapporo is where they are located, and there have been extensive developments of power plants in that area which have encroached on the ants' territory. But ultimately, these ants are so adaptable and so numerous that it would be an incredible challenge to try to change their behavior, to try and stop them, and to try and to go against their momentum. It would be extremely difficult.
Are they dangerous to humans?
They can sting and they spit venom, but I only imagine they'd be dangerous if you filled a bathtub with them and dove in and started to roll around and really got them angry. But otherwise, they're just going about their business, and generally they're not encroaching on human societies, although they can move into people's places. Generally, all they're looking for is food.
And they're expanding constantly, which is sounds more like man's behavior, doesn't it?
It does, and it's interesting how people tend to draw parallels between man and insect colonies. However, our tendency to anthropomorphize and romanticize nature when, if we actually look at it for what it is, it's a lot more complicated and interesting than if we simply look at it in terms of what we already understand. For instance, ant societies are predominantly composed of sterile females, and the male ants only appear for 1 or 2 days out of the year to create new colonies, and for the most part, the ant colony is completely matriarchal. However, it also has, if we look at it in human terms, aspects of totalitarian society, except taken to an incredible extreme where any deviance in behavior is punished by death, and there are police ants and security ants and rigid security measures among these creatures, which is part of what makes it so interesting that they've altered this behavior at all, because it's really allowed them to make tremendous advances in numbers, and in some cases they've eliminated 90% of competitive ant species in the areas that they've infested.
Do we regard them as intelligent creatures? Or?
Among insects, they could be regarded as intelligent. They do have one of the largest brains of any insects. 250,000 brain cells is what they're dragging around. But compared to us, at we're easily over 11 billion brain cells. They aren't significantly intelligent, and the type of intelligence that they have is very different, because they generally are not considered to be learning creatures. For the most part, we believe that they function basically following programs that have been established genetically.
Now, you're talking about Argentine ants, and those, we have them here.
Yes, indeed,
I have my garden.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, our local environment, the Georgia Basin, is perfectly suitable for the development of an ant supercolony. So the other missing element that I haven't mentioned is is shipping. That's how these Argentine ants came to Europe over the last 50 or so years. They were brought over possibly in plants, possibly in shipments of sugar. And so with our very, very busy port, I think it's incredibly possible that these ants could and will set up shop locally.
Now, we see them at a particular time of the year. They come into the house. And so the idea is not to go and spray and everything, but not to have the food that they're after available in your house. And you form these long lines. Are you familiar with their cycle here in British Columbia?
I am, actually. And last summer I was enjoying their reproductive spree, where millions of ants were erupting out of colonies, winged ants. This is when the males appear. And the people outside were terrified, brushing the ants off of their bodies. And I noticed piles of white powder along sidewalks, around houses and things like that, when if everyone had just held their breath for a couple of days, the ants would have disappeared again. And it appears like they've been handled by the pesticides and things like that, but really they're just following their natural cycle.
So, Andrew, I have a few fruit trees in my garden, and they, of course, they have their own cows.
Yes.
Like, tell us about this, how they farm aphids.
All right. Ants are...
And I'll tell you how I treat it.
All right. Ants are fantastic farmers of aphids. Yes, they actually feed off of the secretions that aphids excrete through their rectum, lovely enough as it seems. And the ant supercolonies are excellent farmers as well. And in places like Christmas Island, they've cultivated so many aphids that they've actually destroyed significant amounts of rainforest undergrowth and created large fungal infestations as well. So hopefully there's somewhere that we can handle this, but as it appears, they're having devastating ecological consequences.
Well, what I do is I take a piece of duct tape, mm-hmm. wrap it around the stem of my tree.
How brilliant.
And then I put some grease on it, Tanglefoot.
There you go.
They won't cross the line.
Absolutely not.
But if there's any part of the tree that's touching with something where they can form a line, somehow or other, the super intelligent ants will find that place and they'll go back. So you
Absolutely.
Have to make sure it's not touching anywhere.
And as soon as one ant has found that place, he's left a pheromonal trail that all of the rest of his colony can follow. And when an ant makes a successful food grab, they communicate by an intriguing method called prophylaxis, where they actually have a small secondary stomach and they vomit into their other ants' mouths. And so the other ants learn exactly where they've been, what they've eaten, all of their pheromonal excretions, if they were agitated, if they had to run away and there was adrenaline in their system or anything like that. It's all known. They can't lie to each other. So these ants will know exactly where that fruit came from and how to get it.
So what are the ants doing in my garden or around the house?
Whatever they want. Generally, they're just being
totally harmless. I mean,
oh, as of yet, yeah, they.
They're not eating the wood. They're not doing any damage or anything.
Certainly not.
Why consider them with fear?
Because I believe in our society we have been rigidly taught. We have programs on television where it's seen as a tremendous obstacle to pop a living insect into your mouth, and people do so with great trepidation. When in actuality, you could go to some place like Australia, where they'll dig witchetty grubs out from the roots of some plants, and that's an insect larva larger than your thumb that has a taste like sort of buttery saltiness that's quite nutritious, 40% more absorbable protein than chicken.
I was staying in Amazonia,
yes,
and in Ecuador, or right on the equator, and I was staying in a little guest house there, and the fellow said to me, "You see this banana tree? Well, it's about 10 feet high. You know what the size of the leaves are of the banana plant?"
Yes.
And he said, "The leafcutter ants are destroying my banana plant. Watch those leaves. It'll be gone by tomorrow."
Fantastic.
Now, there's a really interesting thing he also told me about their colony, leafcutter ants, because they'll carry away a piece of banana leaf that's larger than themselves.
Absolutely.
But also, are you familiar with the fungus and how they feed the queen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These ants actually will create a fungus. The leaves that they're collecting are compost for a garden. They've grown a specific type of fungus, and we as humans have tried for decades to cultivate this fungus, and we've never been able to do it successfully. So these ants are creating a specific fungus that they use to feed their colony. So they're doing fantastic work.
But they also feed the queen this particular type of fungus, and then she grows big and can lay millions of little eggs.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's miraculous. Now, just one more thing before.
Oh, yes.
Is also, because you know I lived in Africa for most of my a large percentage of my life, and my friends in Harare, they have a, she has a ant heap in the backyard.
Yes.
And she's an ant, as I said to you before the program, she's an entomologist. Now, this ant heap, which they make out of mud, is about 3 feet high. And they change the vent on top each day so that the temperature is always regular inside. I mean,
it's pretty staggering. These ants are incredible architects. They have air conditioning systems. They have transportation systems. They have waste disposal systems. They have brooding chambers and royal queen chambers and things like that. They have quite complex societies, and that is why we often compare them to our own. However, the level of organization among ants far surpasses anything that any human or group has ever achieved, and we could learn a lot from them and their societies.
Now they have their natural predator, which of course is the anteater.
Yes.
But in South Africa, it's called aardvark.
Aardvark. Yes, I know
which
that.
Which is earth pig. Aardvark. That's the name. And of course, they scratch the pile, put their tongues out, and the ants walk onto their tongue,
and
whoopee-doo, gone.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Yeah, that's a really large meal to be had really quickly.
This is all fascinating. What comes first, the aphid or the ant? Because I used to have to take care of flower boxes on a second-story window, and all of a sudden it would seem overnight the aphids would appear, and then it seemed that the ants were there too. Now, how did they get up in the second-story flower boxes, and particular plants only, and suddenly there were, you know, there was like a whole living system there. And I thought, do I have to kill these things?
No.
But they would kill the flowers eventually.
Oh, absolutely. So. And there are some things you can do to prevent aphids from attacking your plants. Keep them well watered, and that brings up the outer turgor pressure and makes a stronger plant. They're harder to pierce with the types of mouth parts that aphids have. But unfortunately, aphids are incredible reproducers. They're born pregnant, and they reproduce parthenogenically. They don't need males to reproduce. Only, again, there's another type of insect whose reliance on males is minimal. At the end of the summer, some males will appear and fertilize some eggs that can last the winter. But for the rest of the year, these aphids are reproducing parthenogenically. So really, you're up against incredible momentum again. And it's best to just choose plants that are not desirable to them. But if you're like me and you want to have a couple of nasturtiums around the house to drop into your salad, it can be a real challenge to keep the aphids off of them.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure whether the ants were controlling the population by consuming them, or whether they were cultivating these.
Well, actually, they are cultivators of aphids, and
what do they get from that that feeds them?
The aphids are sucking the juices out of your plants, and then they excrete a very sweet substance that the ants will collect. And ants actually, if you destroy their nest and the population has to move, they'll gather up their aphids and take them with them. So they're shepherds as well as cultivators.
Incredible. Now, am I being cruel when I deprive them of their feeding grounds here when I put that tanglefoot around the tree stem?
Not really. We are people who concentrate an abundance of food in our society, so we really continue to do our best to invite these ants into our world by just leaving food around. And it's the same way that creatures like cats have become friends of humans, chasing the rats out of our grain stores and things like that. So it's really, there's not much we can do except to limit our food supply. And most people aren't even prepared to begin to make the types of changes that are required to do that.
Well, agriculture has a tremendous impact on the insect world, of course. What do you advise on behalf of humanity? What to do?
On behalf of humanity, I think we are making some grave errors in terms of how we perceive our natural environment and how we seek to manipulate it for our benefit.
And it's having disastrous results already, we can see, but there are those gigantic companies which stand in the way of progress.
Absolutely, absolutely.
By going us back to nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And we could do a lot better by planting crops that actually many plants have resistance to insects. If you plant your tomatoes and your potatoes together, the insects won't attack them because of the excretions of the actual plants. So there's really simple ways to get around it, but people are making a lot of money selling fertilizer to the world. So
genetic engineering
absolutely.
Is a part of that, and of course our government is fully active in promoting this kind of pathway.
Absolutely, and it will be, we will pay the price because insects are incredibly resilient. They've been around on our planet for over 400 million years. We are just a flash in the pan. We're a very interesting extinction event. We've created many new environmental elements on our world, but I really believe when I look at the whole picture of geology and what's been happening on the planet, I think that we might bounce ourselves out of the ecosystem and things like insects will continue on without us.
Well, it's up to individuals like us to transform our habits as well.
Absolutely.
Leave it up to government, nothing will happen. We need to change ourselves.
Yeah, and
eating natural food and organic food.
Absolutely, and people have to know about that in order to make the choice.
Yeah, now we always have animal rights and animal welfare people on our show, and we've never had anybody protecting insects. Are there groups that actually do that?
Not that I'm aware of. In the case of the ant super colony on Hokkaido, the scientists were relatively dismayed because there was no one they could approach. There were no protective agencies that would respond to the disaster that's confronting the red ant super colony in the face of urban development. So it's really a funny thing, but ultimately, I think that since we've left insects on their own, that's how they've managed to survive for so long. So I don't really see them suffering on the long term. I think a million years from now will be long forgotten, and insects will just keep plugging on.
Well, yes, I think they'll certainly survive, but we like to make them comfortable while they're here.
And these super colonies aren't preparatory steps to overwhelming us, is it?
Oh, I actually, in my heart of hearts, I sort of see this as better than any ant science fiction movie or story that I've ever read, short of one by Frank Herbert called The Green Brain, where it was actually about a collective insect society in the future where people were fighting against insects, and actually they were losing all plant life because of the destruction of the pollinating insects. But for the most part, we see a movie from the 70s where the ants get together and they built like an 8-foot tall regular structure, and the scientist was staggered by this development, and something like that is nothing compared to a 6,000 kilometer organization. It's really nothing.
I'm afraid we've about run out of time. It's been exciting having you with us, Andrew, and we certainly want you to come back again. But before I close this off, are there any places where people can go to learn about these super ant colonies?
The best resource I found has been the internet. This past year, many reputable publications have produced articles about the super colony, National Geographic, the American Academy of Science, and if you just got online and looked at a search engine and typed in super colony, you'd find at least 20 articles about them.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrew Scott, for being with us today. Andrew is a person who gives nature interpretation walks for the Stanley Park Ecology Society. He's also an artist who sculpts insects out of plastic and metal. So that we are looking forward to having Andrew back. He has a wonderful knowledge about insects.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great. All right. We'll take a little station break and a little musical break. This is CFRO 102.7 FM. You're listening to Animal Voices. We'll be right back with Connie Vogel.
Welcome everyone again to Animal Voices. We have a very special guest today. It's Connie Vogel, and she is the leader of the Canada Action Party. She's a lawyer, former teacher, and the widow of Harry Rankin, the flamboyant former Vancouver City Councillor. Welcome, Connie Vogel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Thank you guys for being here. It's so important that this alternate expression of media exists. You're becoming more and more valuable and important that maybe you even realize.
It's such a critical time in our history as well. Of course, every moment is critical, but you have a very special message. And may I ask you, what kind of Canada do you envisage? I mean, slightly different from what we have now.
I'm speechless because I can tell you that the Canada that's being recreated, reshaped, is a police state. And that's a staggering reality that is not being discussed, and I want to talk about that today.
Go ahead.
Okay. In Canada, we've often complained that we don't really have very good representation at the federal government level. And people have complained from time to time that our prime minister operates in a dictatorial way. Well, it's more true now than ever. The prime minister of Canada, the president of the United States, and the president of Mexico in March of 2005 signed an agreement amongst themselves called the Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement. It was March 2005. And that agreement essentially rubber stamps sanctions, promises to put into effect the agenda of the most influential corporate organizations in North America. The plan is to create a unified North America by the year 2010. I may have talked about this on this program once before. I'm not sure.
We want to hear it again.
Okay. The chief executive officers of the corporate elite, of the most influential corporations, I'm not talking about little incorporated small businesses, of course. I'm talking about the major players who have, in some cases, financing situations amongst themselves that are greater than the financing power of a country. We have some of those in Canada and the United States and in Mexico. These guys don't, they have no allegiance to countries, no allegiance to nations, no allegiance to people. Their allegiance is only to profit. They want everything removed in forms of regulations that interfere with their opportunity to make profit, that increases their costs. That's been their agenda from day one. Their raison d'etre is to create profit, and nothing else matters. They have no soul, they have no heart, they have no morality.
That's why you speak out about globalization.
Well, that's right. That's what the whole process is. We've been talking about this for many, many years now, the whole movement of people internationally against the corporatization process, I think we're all probably well versed in. But what is staggeringly shocking and frightening to me is the extent to which that power is entrenched in North America and is affecting us in Canada. By that agreement, what's so awful is that we've got a prime minister who has met with two other leaders, and they've basically sat down amongst themselves and created this agreement, and they've promised to effect this agenda of the corporate elite. And then they turn around, each of these leaders of the respective three countries, and they pick three special cabinet ministers in their respective governments and say, okay, you guys, your job is to go off and now implement this. Emerson, Pettigrew, and McClelland are the three in Canada. Emerson is in my riding, David Emerson.
So Canadian sovereignty is being threatened by this?
It's more than threatened.
Enlarge on that.
It's more than threatened. It's being destroyed. We all are aware of the impact of NAFTA economically. We've been talking about that for years, the deep integration that's being affected economically by the NAFTA agreement. First of all, the free trade agreement, Canada-US, and then the NAFTA, which brought in Mexico. And economically, we've become more and more deeply integrated with the United States. And, of course, recently we all know the shock of the NAFTA. If the ruling goes against them, they just say, to hell with you guys, we're not, you know, it doesn't apply this time. I'm speaking specifically of the lumber dispute, where $5 billion of the Canadian lumber industry was basically stolen from the lumber industry in Canada and handed over to the lumber industry of the United States, and the United States has absolutely no intention of paying that money or giving it back. So NAFTA was the first prong. This new agreement, and first of all, let me say the chief executive officers of these, and I've got the reports, actually I've pulled this stuff off the internet. They're so comfortable and happy. They brag about the fact that they were instrumental in bringing in the NAFTA, and that you know, that was the beginning of their thrust of control of the region, and very happy at how they moved the governments to implement that. Now you see this new agreement, this Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement, goes beyond the economic. It goes into the military. It goes into the judicial. It goes into the legal structure. It goes into the policing structure. It affects all the fundamental, basic core structures of our social order. It basically emasculates, attacks, removes our constitutional rights and entitlements and our civil liberties because of the kinds of intention that's in there. Listen to the words, security and prosperity. It sounds great, doesn't it? We all want to be secure, we all want to prosper, but let's be very clear. It's not prosperity and security for the people. It's prosperity for the corporations, and the security means mechanisms put in place to make sure that their interest is protected and secure, and that means the people have to be controlled. Dissent has to be controlled, because once people truly understand, they're not going to stand for it, so they have to be controlled, therefore the police state.
So the 9/11 has undermined our civil liberties.
9/11 was the excuse to put this agenda into place. It was the justification. You scare the people, you frighten them, and so you make them, you get them, you soften them up into being willing to accept the loss of their liberties, which we must never accept. But we haven't been asked, you see, properly. After 9/11, everybody went into, all the elected people went into panic mode. And yes, we've just got to do this and do this and do this. And it's all justified under the name of security. And the bad thing for us is that it never was properly taken to the people. That Anti-Terrorism Act... And incidentally, let me just back up a minute. The 9/11, it was September 2001. By December of 2001, Canada had entered an agreement with the United States called the Smart Border Declaration, by which Canada promised to bring in anti-terrorism legislation, promised to bring in the various kinds of laws that would streamline Canada with what the United States is doing, all the border arrangements, a whole bunch of civil liberty stripping matters. We started that in 2001. Our parliamentarians just jump into line and rubber stamp anything. So I want to jump back to my point about the dictatorial situation in Canada. The anti-terrorism law is under review right now, but our government, on the government website, it clearly states we have no intention of revoking this law. They're basically looking at ways to make it even stronger. So here we've got a prime minister of a country who has gone beyond the NAFTA, has begun to implement the streamlining, the deharmonization, deep integration with the United States, all on the United States agenda of how they're going to do it there. The policy decisions are made there. And the reality is that our parliamentarians are not doing their job. They're failing us miserably, miserably, miserably. They don't even know about this Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement. I'm on the campaign trail right now. Ian Waddell is running for the NDP. He lost by only about 1,500 votes to Emerson, who is Paul Martin's architect to implement this grand design. I'm sorry?
Industry minister.
That's right. Sorry. Industry minister. That's correct. And Ian Waddell doesn't have a clue of what I'm talking about. It's very bad, the kind of opportunity we have. It's really next to no opportunity as a candidate in the public meetings that go on. The format of them, if you have any at all, is not good. Sometimes you're not allowed on the stage if you're a small party. I only have had one good one where I was able to go after Emerson. The fact is you've got the Prime Minister of Canada exercising dictatorial powers with the United States, who's proud of the fact that he could be a dictator and he's got taken his powers to be able to overrule the fact that they're not supposed to torture. We've got he's saying to Prime Minister Martin, well, you know, you're the Prime Minister, just do what you want. And so we've got Prime Minister Martin, in fact, doing what he wants, having these three people do what they want. And these guys are effecting treason, as far as I'm concerned, in my matter, because it doesn't go to the Parliament. When it does go, they don't know what they're doing anyway. They rubber stamp it, so maybe it doesn't make much difference. But the reality is, here we've got candidates for the NDP who should be, they're the people that have the potential, again, to be the power in terms of a minority government. But I'm so worried because they don't even seem to know what's going on. They don't know what Ian Waddell clearly doesn't know anything about this agreement. I talked to Libby Davies, saw her last night or the night before, and I mentioned something about this. She said, oh yeah, I've heard something about that. You know, it's such a profound arrangement of structural change. These guys have a duty to learn this kind of thing. Ian Waddell's talking when he asked questions about crime and things like this. How are you going to deal with this? His answer is punishment.
Guns and gays.
More gun control and punishment. I mean, the NDP has... I'm so worried because they're the ones that we have to rely on, and yet I'm thankful for you giving me the opportunity to come here and talk. Because
I just want to recap a little bit here because I think it's so important that people see the larger picture, and that's why I'm so in admiration of the Canada Action Party, because I believe that the picture you've painted here is what we don't normally hear. And let me just recap here a little bit of what you said. You know, it's you said we have a dictatorship, the divine right of kings, as
right,
you said.
Right, right.
And it's all reinforced together with a system of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, globalization. And to my mind, our sovereignty is being undermined. Our civil liberties is at stake. And we need a party that puts forward what you are doing. That's my honest opinion. Yeah.
They're not being undermined. Let's be clear. They're being sabotaged, deliberately being sabotaged. This is unspeakable. It's incredible. And if the people only really knew, if the people really only knew the power even in the financial, in the banking industry, if the people only really knew the power that's being exercised by unelected, unaccountable people because the bureaucracy is behind the scenes moving all this stuff and they've been assigned the job by Emerson and Pettigrew and McClellan to get on with the restructuring Canada, we can't control them. It's who would have thought that the very core of our democracy could just slip away from us like this? People have to come to understand we're in a very bad state.
Now, the very bad state, one of your candidates, Merlin, maybe you
yes.
can just say, where is he running?
He's in Vancouver East.
Vancouver East. And he pointed out to me this the system of the banks and the Canadian national debt.
Right.
And who's getting the interest on that, and what is your policy on that?
Well,
What is the national debt?
we've got
$200 billion.
No, $500 billion. Over $500 billion.
What happens to interest?
Well, it goes to the private banking system. Is only about $37 billion of that debt goes to the running of, say, of our social programs. People.
Do you believe it's largely a gift to the?
Absolutely.
The banking institutions.
Absolutely.
Explain that a bit, because I'm outraged on that.
Yes, well, the Canadian Action Party has been trying to remind Canadians since our inception in 1997 that we're very fortunate in this country that we have a mechanism, a legal entity called the Bank of Canada, which belongs to Canada, the government. Our nation is their sole shareholder, and we can use that bank to do the banking of the basic fundamental infrastructure, the core things for the nation, without having to pay interest. And whereas if you go to the private banks, which is what our governments are doing now, they're in the business of making money, and that's what banking business is all about, and they make it by their interest. We used our Bank of Canada. The Bank of Canada was created in 1938. At difficult times in the world and in Canada, and the power of our bank was used until about the mid 1970s. By power, I simply mean the choice was made to use the power of the Bank of Canada to fund the needs of the economy. And it only funded up to about 25%. It wasn't even 100%. And at that time, it was during those years that the best programs in Canada were created. The infrastructure was rebuilt after the war, World War, highways, housing, I think of the word for the main architecture and structures on the water routes, transportation system generally. That's quite right. Bridges and. All of that, you see, was funded. And when the government, the government has to borrow the money from somewhere. It has to get the money from somewhere. It doesn't exist in somebody's basement or in a big cave somewhere. And the government, somebody goes out and pulls it out and puts it in the economy, and someone stands at the gate saying you can have so much today or so much tomorrow. It is created. Somebody makes a decision. Financial arrangements are decided. A government decides we need this much, and so they go to the private banks and they say, I need $100 million for this, and the private banks, okay, puts his finger on a little computer and $100,000 suddenly exists in an account. We can do that whether we do it by our Bank of Canada or whether we do it by the private banks. So this is another hidden secret. It's another betrayal of the interest of Canadians, because we do not have to be imprisoned by that debt. We are a debt-based economy, and it doesn't have to be that way. It does not have to be that. We're not the only ones in the world talking about this. All sorts of countries in the world are talking about freeing us from the enslavement of debt-controlled financial situation. It's not new. But we're so lucky. We could be out, and we have people in power who refuse to exercise that. They refuse. They refuse. Why do they refuse? Because they're interested in the most important corporate structures of the world, the primary ones of which are financial.
So the banks create money out of nothing,
mm-hmm.
which is something that a government can do.
Because
if a government can print a bond and then sell it to a financial institution at interest, why can't it print a dollar bill?
Well, it's not just the matter of printing a dollar bill. Our Bank of Canada is the one responsible for, it's about 3-5% of the money that goes into the financial needs of the economy do come from the Bank of Canada. That's the hard currency that we have, the dollar bills, the coins and so on. That is issue. That is come through the arrangements through our government. But that's not where the big money is. The big money is not in what's created in the mint. It's not the dollar bill, the $5 bill, the loonie or the toonie that you carry around in your pocket. The big money is in the large sums of money that are created by the bank just simply putting an entry in a computer and saying, all right, we're releasing $250 billion or $250 million for this project to fund something that the government needs in this area. And then the government pays them interest on it. Instead of going to the private bank, we could have that issue. But by simply a computer entry through our Bank of Canada. I ask people to please go to our website, www.canadianactionparty.ca. There is a tutorial on that website about the Bank of Canada. People need to arm themselves with this information. When we really understand it, we become so furious that we're being fooled and cheated and stolen from.
Now, I had a look at it this morning, and I think, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's the interest on the national debt is $34 billion
a
year.
Yes, yes.
And so...
And let me just tell you
now,
this.
Now, imagine if we didn't have to give this gift to the banks,
absolutely,
the corporations,
absolutely,
which force globalization to us, this kind of dictatorship, the surveillance on us, our infringement on our civil liberties, we would be able to ensure that what is happening right now, that a child dies of starvation on this planet every 2 seconds,
yeah,
that does not happen.
Yeah.
But there are many other injustices. And one of the other things is we like to think of Canadians as being very high on the list of child poverty. But Mel Hertig had an article which he sent out which said that in a list of 25 OECD countries, 18 have lower child poverty rates than Canada. In other words, Canada fared some 19th on the list out of 25 countries as regards child poverty.
Yeah.
In other words, we fared worse than many third world countries as regards child poverty.
Yeah.
What is this?
It's immoral. It's immorality is what it is. It's evil. Totally unnecessary. We're one of the richest countries in the world in human resources and in natural resources. And in terms of understanding financing of our country, another mechanism exists by which the government pretends that we're less valuable, we have less worth than we really do. It's the way they do their books. And the kinds of gifts and arrangements that they give to the banking industry by allowing them to not have to hold reserves, for instance. I don't want to take the time to get into the complications of a lot of this. But the reality is that in 1975, when we were still using our Bank of Canada for only 25% of the needs of the country, the debt was $37 billion. It was in the mid-70s that we stopped using it. And as soon as we stopped using it, the debt escalated and escalated and escalated because of the interest that we were paying. It's So when the government pretends to us, they lie to us saying we don't have money, we can't afford this. That's such a lie because, for one thing, if they valued the health and the education of our human resources and put that into the equation of the value of the country, which is the mechanism that you need in terms of the overall value for being able to make your economy function, we would be seen to be of untold wealth. That's why it's fundamentally important to fund education and to fund health in a very strong way, because that is part of your resources. I have to make this point. I know you want to jump in. I have so much to say. After the Second World War, economists were asked to tell the Western world how long it would take for Germany and Japan to become a power again, a force that the world might have to worry about. And the projections they made were wrong. They estimated it would be a much longer period than it took. They jumped back very, very quickly. And so an economist was asking later, well, what happened here? Why were you guys wrong? And he said, well, we failed to take into account the human resource, measure the discipline of the people, their education, their intelligence, their health, and those two nations had high levels of education and of healthy people, and it was that equation that was not brought into the economic equation, and so they failed to be able to project properly how fast these people would recover. The point is, it's so fundamentally important to recognize that when you're funding education and you're funding health, this is a resource that lasts forever. You put it on the books when you put so much money in. It never has to be written off. It never has to be taken away because it goes on forever.
Right. Now, part of this whole scene is, and you're in the media so much, when you came here and the first things you said, thank you for being on Co-op Radio because this is an avenue where we can speak out, and we love it that you speak out. But I would be remiss in not asking you somehow other with the... what is the media doing to us, the control of the media, and are they telling it like it isn't?
They're telling it like it isn't, and you have to realize, when I was researching this work on the corporate elite who have this, you know, are being successful in having their agenda implemented more specifically, I accessed information about, you know, who these people actually are, and there's a whole list of the ones in Canada, but very fundamentally part of this group are the global the media chains. You've got CanWest, you've got CanWest Global Communications, you've got, I'm just looking at some of them here.
Chum.
All of these people who are part of this, they're part of this elite who want to take over the, total North America. Here's another one, Rogers Communication, Inc. Just tell us.
Give us a little overview of how you see the election running right now. I mean, what do you see that probably most people don't see?
Oh, I don't think I see anything different from what most people see. Everybody knows the predictions are we're probably going to have a minority government, and that's good for us because it buys us some more time. It doesn't really matter whether Harper or Martin gets back in because they both have the same agenda. They're both complicit in delivering us over to the North American agenda ruled under the power of the United States. We have no independent policy anymore. Foreign policy, immigration policy, our judicial policies are changing dramatically. We're being directed so much. Harper would only be different than that he would do it faster. It's very crucial that there be another minority government. My concern is that the NDP is not going to be strong enough on the things that we need to protect us. If the Bloc Québécois ends up being the real power base and makes an arrangement with whoever gets in there, it's just going to be an escalation more quickly of the death of Canada.
We're speaking to Connie Fogel from the Canada Action Party. And Marge, you have a question. We have about three minutes left,
okay.
I think.
Yes, Connie.
2 minutes left.
I would like to ask you if there's any chance of overcoming all these problems that you have outlined and regaining our independence with the present electoral system.
No, that's what I wanted to address when I first came in here, is the fundamental need when I was talking about the power that the Prime Minister asserts, his divine right of kings attitude, and they're doing it, they're getting away with it. We don't have, proportional representation isn't enough, because that would just propel people into Parliament, and they still would rubber stamp stuff, and they'd still have the bureaucracy making all these decisions and doing things, and the Prime Minister and a few cabinet ministers would run off and do stuff and come back and then implement it, and our parliamentarians would simply rubber stamp it. That's a beginning of proportional representation. We have to go further than that into some form of direct democracy, citizen initiative, citizen recall, so that we can pull these people back and command them to control the bureaucracy and to change the way the system works fundamentally. It's revolution that we have to talk about in a civil way, and yes, it can be done. People must never despair. People have always come back in terrible times of history. Hope and goodness and right have always conquered, and it will again. It's just we have to realize in Canada we're on the front line. We've got to fight, people. We've got to get up there and stand up for ourselves.
On that optimistic note, I'd like to thank you very much, and we're right out of time. And over to our host, John Pranger.
And sorry, Inga Hanley, we couldn't get you on the line, Inga, sorry. That's the end of the show, folks. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices, and thanks to Connie Fogel and Andrew Scott for being our guests today. Our website is animalvoices.org. We're going to post this show on the website today. And the program is repeated Monday at 4 p.m. Please join us again next week for another edition of Animal Voices. Have a great day.